who, and they are heroes, guys in AA who you know who meant so much to you. And you realize as time goes on, we're talking about real people. We're not talking about biblical heroes. We're talking about people that we met in our lifetime in many cases. It's not going way back historically and trying to find someone who's a hero. It's like, this guy's a hero. He picked me up and took me to my first meeting. He held my hand when I went through the steps. He heard my fifth step. He knows everything about me. He comes to my house once in a while. We socialize. This is a real life person. And that's the exciting part of this thing for me. I don't have any idea most of the time what's going on anymore. But I don't really care. I don't really care because I find out the people who do know just don't seem to be that happy with the knowledge. You know, do you ever watch people who know a lot? They kind of sit there like, yeah, give me a chance to tell you something. You know, and they don't laugh a lot, you know. They kind of have these faces like Preparation H, you know. And you say, geez, you know, this guy doesn't look real happy. But guys that come to me, they know I'm happy because they'll say, Ken, what do you know? And I'll go, nothing. Absolutely nothing. And they'll say, well, when did you get to that point? I always tell them yesterday. Because last week I thought I knew something. Just so happened I was wrong. You know, but you know, it doesn't slow you down. And that's why with you guys, I was thinking, now see, I get real elaborate in my mind because it's got to do stuff. Otherwise it takes me places. And I was thinking, you know, like, you guys should have like a group photo every year of all the guys who come here and put it up on a bulletin board. And then, you know, over the years, keep track of those guys. You know, like, where did they go? How are they doing? Are they still coming back? You know, maybe all of you take a picture and make it in a puzzle and call it the Dominican or whatever the order, the Benedictine puzzle. And next year when you come back, you put your picture back into the puzzle and we know you're there. I mean, anything to keep track of people, you know, because we're on loan to each other and it's real important we keep track of each other because really out there, not too many people are really interested. You know, not too many people are really interested. And that's why I'm involved, totally immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is the deal that works for me. I'm sure there are other deals that work for other people, but this is the deal that works for me. You know, I look at my life and I say to myself that each day of my life is so very different in some ways than the day that preceded it. In some ways it's the same, and in other ways it's totally different. And the difference is in what I can see today that I couldn't see yesterday. You know, as many of you shared with me, several of you went and took a fifth step. I took my fifth step with a priest also. His name was Father Rip. He was a Dominican, and he was at the first retreat I went to. And the reason I took my fifth step with him is because I felt like the statute of limitations hadn't run out in some areas, and that, as several people mentioned, he was a good guy to talk to. And we talked for a while, and when we got done, I remember what he said to me. He said, this is the beginning of a journey. He said, I have no idea where this journey is going to take you, but if you stay with this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, because he was an alcoholic also, he said, but if you stay with this program, he said, things will work out for you. He said, I can't tell you how, and I can't tell you when, but they'll work out for you. And you know, for the longest time, I had that as a recurring theme in my head. And I have seen in my life where things have worked out for me. We moved to California in 1974. My wife and I had been separated for 18 months when I first got sober. We decided to get back together. And then when we got back together, my kids were running into me everywhere they went. They went to school and people said, oh, you know, we know your dad. We read about him. And so the people, so my wife said, you know, this won't work. We got to do something. This just won't work. And I said, okay, let's think about moving. She said, where? I said, I have no idea. So we sold off all our assets and we got the $18.20. And then we decided we would head west. And we came to California, and we had no idea where we were going to live in California. Absolutely no idea. And then we had one friend who lived in a place called Fontana. So we went to this place. And she was really of no value to us because when we arrived there, her husband had left her the night before we got there. So she had her own set of problems. So my wife said, well, what do you think we should do? And I said, let's take a map. We'll start at the southernmost point. We'll go up the whole state, and when we feel comfortable in a place, we'll settle there. Now, prior to leaving to go out, my sponsor and his family, which was a very large family, invited us over for dinner, my family. And when we were finished with that dinner, we knelt down on the floor, all of us, and we held hands. And they said a prayer for us that we would be okay in this journey, because they knew there was a lot going on. I was newly sober. I didn't know a whole lot. We were getting back together. There was a lot of sensitivity, things that had to be worked out with the things that happened in the past. There was just a lot going on. So we all prayed together. And he said something to me that was turned out to be very insightful. He said, when you get to California, I know you do not go to any church. You were raised a Catholic. Go to the church and go at least 6 months and promise me you'll go every Sunday for 6 months. Because you're going to need the additional input since you don't have any support system. And I said I would do that. So we got into Fontana on a Saturday. I went to church there Sunday. And then we decided we'd go down to San Diego and start this odyssey up the coast. Went down to San Diego, rented a place at San Diego State for 6 weeks and while the faculty was out. And when August came, the end of August, we had to move out of there. And we were just going to get in the car and move up the coast. That was our game plan. Well, the second week I was there, I went to a church. And the church I went to, of course, had a priest who was saying the Mass. He was an Irish priest, and when he finished saying the Mass, I enjoyed what he had to say. So I went up to him, and I said, I enjoyed the Mass, Father, and thank you for what you said. My name is Ken Devaney, and I just moved here from back east. And he said, my name is Bill Wilson. And I said to him, we were thinking of settling in the area, but we're not sure. And he said, let me give you this card. This is a feller in the parish who does real estate work. I said, great. So I took the card, and I looked at it, and it said, Bob Smith Realty. I began to think something was going on here. Now, that story was the beginning of my settling in San Diego. That individual came into AA 2 years later and is still sober and still very active. And some of you may have even had him speak at different functions of yours. And I went home and I said to my wife, you know, I'm not making this up, because she always used to say, come on, tell me the truth. Honey, I'm not making this up, but the priest's name is, and this is the card he gave me. And she said, well, let's look for a place here. So we looked for a place there. And the first place we took turned out to be just the right place. It was a little apartment, had a pool. It was 8 units in this little area of La Mesa. And the second month I was there, I was supposed to have money coming in from a place I had worked. They were going to send me the little pension money that I was withdrawing, and that was going to keep us going and pay the rent. And for some reason, they had a paper foul up, and the money didn't come. So the very first month I owed this guy rent after being in there for a month, I didn't have it. So I went down, just the way the book tells me to do, and I said to him, here's the deal. I'm expecting this money. I thought it would be here. It's not here. I can't pay you the rent. It's due. Please tell me what you want me to do. And he said, well, we're real happy with you and your wife and your kids. He said, it's enjoyable having you here. He said, why don't we wait a week or two and see what happens? And money came in, and we paid. And a year and a half, I went to work for a company. Unemployment was very rampant at that time. That was when Nixon was making his exit, and the economy in San Diego was in chaos. Unemployment was about 13%. So I went and applied for a job doing something I had done 20 years earlier. And I was hired to do that job. And I went to work with that company. And the guy who hired me was a kind of a tough taskmaster, and he seemed to be much harsher than one would have to be. And as time went on, I began to realize he had a drinking problem. And 1 year to the day after their hiring me, they promoted me to his job. And he was so incensed, he left the company. And that was in 1975. And I lost complete track of him. And in 1984, he walked into an AA meeting. And the end of this month, I will give him his cake because I'm his sponsor. Now, everybody that I know of who's been here any amount of time can take random facts and put them together and make a story. In my life, I don't know whether these are random facts or not. I just know they're facts. I just know that when we were coming cross country, I had a Bel Air Chevy wagon that was kind of worn, which means not that hot. And we were hauling a little tiny U-Haul. And as I came through Des Moines, a tire blew on that U-Haul. And I'm not mechanically inclined. You know, I'm a real city boy. So I stopped at a gas station. I said, "Can you do anything about this?" And the guy said, "No." He said, "But I wouldn't worry." He said, 100 yards up the road is the Midwest Terminal for U-Haul repairs. He said, "Just drive up there and they'll take care of it." So I drove up and we went to lunch and they didn't even have to unload the van. They just had the equipment to pick it up and change that tire. And that whole trip was marked by a whole series of events. And my arrival there and what happened every step of the way seemed to be just what we needed. And as a family, something special happened to us. Because when you don't have a lot of other people that you know, and you don't have a lot of activities taking you in different directions, you spend a lot of time together. And we had beanbag chairs because we didn't have a whole lot of furniture. And we sat in those beanbag chairs, and as a family, we came together. And as I look back now, everything that happened, happened to bring us together. Had we stayed where we were, that transformation would have never happened. The transformation that has happened in me from the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is the transformation that I listen to happening in other people. You know, I do things randomly and recklessly. I bought a piece of property at one time in New Jersey, a farm piece of property. I had never lived off a city block, and I bought farm property. And I moved where we had 4.5 acres. I didn't even have a clipper for a hedging. We moved into that house. And in fact, the guy who sold me the equipment there, every time I went into him and his son, he would say, "You going to tell us about something?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, wait till my son is done with a customer." We both like to laugh, you know. So, because my stories were just unbelievable. I bought a ride-on tractor from that guy. And the first day I used the tractor, he said, "Take it out, try it out, and let us know if it does the job." And so I called him and said, "You know, it cuts the thin grass real good, but the thick grass makes noises as it cuts." He said, "The thick grass?" I said, "Yes." He said, "We'll come out." His name was Mr. Potter. He said, "My son and I will come out." So they came out, and he said, "Show me the thick grass." So I showed him, and they both start laughing. And he said, "You cut about 3/4 of an acre of asparagus." You know? He said, "That's not thick grass, you know." But this thing was coming off the mud, ping, ping, like a ricochet. And I said, that's not thick grass. He said, no. He said, "That's asparagus. That's where it grows. It comes out of the ground like that." He said, "The grass has grown around it," he said, "but it grows wild here." He said, "They must have planted it here at one time." So I said, "Oh, okay." So I learned the difference between asparagus and thick grass. You know? My wife didn't like the way the water was doing the laundry, so I called the water company and said, "Can you come out and do something?" Because I know that's what you do. You call city water. So they came out. They laughed. They said, "You got well water. You're drawing water from a stream that runs through here. And what you have to do is," they took me downstairs and they showed me this water softener. And they said, "You got to put rock salt in here and you got to do this and you got to take care of this and this water will process through here. And you're really in good shape because there's a water shortage and you have your own water." And I said, "Oh, And then my neighbor, who lived maybe a half a mile down the road, he said to me, "You notice that in back of us is a sod farm, 25 acres of sod farm. It's all flat. It was great in the summer when the kids could play out there." He said, "In the winter, when we get snow, there's nothing to stop it from coming against the house and into the driveway." He says, "Do you have a plow piece of equipment for your mower?" "No." He said, "You better get one." Well, I had other things to do. There was drinking. There was, you know, just other things to be done. And I didn't get that piece of equipment. And I woke up one day, and it looked like Alaska had come to my home. And I had snow in the driveway like a foot and a half, 2 feet deep. And we were 50, 60 yards from the road. And I could hear this put, 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 put down the road, you know, show off. And he had his piece of equipment. And he was out cleaning his drive. So I took my little aluminum shovel, and I got out to the road, and there was a truck coming by. It was a county truck, and he was cleaning the road. And I said, "Can you do this driveway for me?" He said, "No, sir, I get paid to do the county roads, and that's it." I said, "Oh." I said, "Can you wait a minute?" He said, "Why?" I said, "Just wait a minute." So I went in the house, and I came out, and I had a pint of Four Roses and $10. And suddenly, I had a piece of equipment, you know? And he came in with a thing called a payloader, and, you know, my piece of equipment was much better than that putt-putt thing, you know? And to show you the kind of guy I am, neighbor, as I rode by, I beeped the horn, you know? And, you know, when I look back, so much of this stuff is funny in the telling, but in the doing, it was a whole other deal, you know? It was a whole other deal. And I get to laugh at a lot of that stuff that I did today simply because I'm sober and I can laugh at it. But it sure wasn't funny when it was going on. It sure wasn't funny when my wife would say things like, "Why are you not cutting that grass?" And I couldn't tell her that there was something wrong with the lawnmower and I didn't know how to fix it. You know, so I would make up these stories about, "I'll do it later, I'll look into it, I'll..." But I just didn't take care of the maintenance of the piece of equipment I had. And the end result was it got real bad, even though it was real new. And as I look on it, that same thing applied to me. I didn't take care of me. I was so busy doing other things. I was so busy enjoying alcohol that I couldn't see what it was doing to me. People around me eventually began to see me. When my brothers, who both had some drinking problems, would say to me, "You got a drinking problem," I would look at them like, geez, this was the master sellout. These guys were like, "You're selling me out." You know, like, and then at the end I realized that we were kind of in it together again, because my brother would call and say, "Let's go get a couple of beers and get arrested." And you know, like, we would just go out of the house and something would happen. You know, we would be right in the middle of something and something else would be going on. And when my wife used to send me out for pizza, I used to say goodnight. She used to say goodbye. You know, goodbye, you know, see you when I see you. Because she knew when I went for that pizza, there's a lot of things that could happen. I could come directly home with it. She could see me Thursday. You know, like, anything could happen. Because once I was out the door, I had a thing. It was, as I look at it now, my disease was metamorphosis. I would start out with something I desired. It would become something I needed. And then I would pray that it was something that God wanted me to have, you know. And I'd say, "Let me just have this, Lord, you know, and we'll work out everything else later." And I had a way of postponing my very existence. And when I came into this program and started hanging out with you guys here in rooms like this, doing exactly what we're doing, I began to realize that there was no postponing this thing. I was going to have to either start doing this stuff or I wasn't going to get to stay here. That's just the way it was. And in the process of learning to stay here, I learned to laugh more and more. A lot of times I laughed at situations that I really wanted to cry at. But if I knew if once I started crying, I wouldn't be able to stop. So I would laugh at them. I would make people think that they weren't bothering me that much. But a lot of times that stuff bothered me. You know, I had an incident in my life with my wife where I almost cost her life. She was coming home with me from a party that she didn't want to come home with me, and I forced her into the car. And as we were coming down the road, she had just had it with me. So she opened the door and just got out. And I didn't know she was gone. And after about a mile or so, and the door flapping back and forth, I came to enough to realize she wasn't in the car. And I circled around and went back, and somebody else had picked her up off the road and taken her to a local hospital. And when I got there, and I walked into the emergency room, and they had this curtain around her, I said, "I'm her husband." And she just heard that and said, "Don't let him in." And I thought, my God, here is somebody who I think, thought, feel that I love, and I have caused them this much damage that they don't even want to see me. Don't even want to see me. And then she came home a couple of days later, and it was Father's Day, and my kids had made things for Father's Day, and here I was packing to get out of the house. And we had done this drill before, and my son said, "Dad, are you coming or going?" And I had to look at him and say, "I don't know." Because at that point, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. I just knew that whatever was going on was not what I had wanted in life. And I left, and like most good alcoholics, I went and moved in with my mom. And then eventually that didn't even work. You know you're in trouble when your mom says you have to get out of here, you know. That's like the last deal. That's the, you know, AA is the last house on the block, but that's the last residence, you know. And I said to my mom, "Why?" Because I was really getting used to where I was living with her, and she said, "Because this is a senior citizen place, and you're supposed to be 65 years or older to live here." And I had lived there a couple of months, and I was getting so used to it, I would use the walker to go to the bathroom. You know, I was starting to get used to being old. You know, like, hey, I'll just get used to this because this is probably where I'm going to end up anyway, you know. And she said, "You can't stay." They sent me a notice saying that you have to be 65 years or older for me to stay here, and for you could stay here for a while, but, you know, I didn't know you were moving in. I thought it was like a weekend deal. And I was there a couple of months. So I had to move out. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that was the first move I made. I moved from my mom's house into my own place. And my sponsor, who was just this great human being, came to visit me. And I was living in an area that was not very desirable. So you had to keep the door locked. And you had to keep the windows locked. And there was a lot of activity in the hall, people doing things with needles and stuff. And he came in and he had a little burning unit that you could cook coffee on. And he said, "I brought you this." Now, you have to try to use your imagination here. I had two orange crates, one holding my lamp and the other one holding a Hummel that my wife let me have because my mom had given it to us. She wasn't too crazy about it. And so I had this Hummel. And when he came, he said, I'd like to sit down somewhere. And you had to sit on the floor. And in order to sit on the floor, he was a little chunky at that time. He wanted something to stabilize himself, so he went to put his hand on the orange crate, and I said, "Whoa, watch out for that Hummel." He said, "Which Hummel?" I said, "That Hummel." At which point he picked it up and said, "This one?" I said, "Yeah," and he threw it. And it hit the plaster walls. It went all over the place. And he said, "Now we can sit down. You don't have to worry about shit." He said, "You now own absolutely nothing of any value." He said, "If anybody breaks in here, they'll just take those orange crates and you get more at the A&P. And I don't know why, but once again, I didn't know how to react to that, you know. One part of me says, "I'm going to hit him with this coffee pot and then put his face on that hot plate." And the other part of me said, "Let go and let God," you know. And but it came very clear to me that what he had done was probably the biggest favor anyone had ever done for me, because he put me in a position where, not having anything to focus on, I got to look at who was there in the room. And there was him, who was doing this deal at that time, 8 or 10 years, and living very comfortably with a family in nice surroundings. And then there was me in what I was living in. And at that moment, it came very clear to me, I wanted what he had. And I then was willing to do anything I had to do to get it. And I said that to him. I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I don't know how long this situation is going to last. But from this day forward, I'm going to be like a tumor on your hip. I'm going to watch you. I'm going to follow you around. I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to take your suggestions. I'm going to do whatever you tell me to do because I have to. I have to start on some kind of a path that gets me out of this situation. And it wasn't just the environment as far as what wasn't there. It was the fact that what I was carrying being there. You know, it was a dual sword for me. And so I started doing just that. I followed him around. I followed his suggestions. I started going to meetings. He hooked me up with people that would let me go to work for him on a per diem basis, and I started doing that. You know, in California, they have these phrases like, what's your career choice? When you're new, like, what's your career choice? And so the person talks for 10 minutes, and when they're done, you have no more idea what they do for a living than when they started. That's not the way we did it in the city. The guy said, hey, yo, get a job. You know, go get a job. What kind? We don't care. You know, like, just go get a job and go to work and do something every single day. And if you don't have something to do work-wise every day, go look for something to do work-wise every day. And I thought, geez, this guy's a tough, but I'll do it. So I not only had to start doing that, but did you ever fill out a resume where the thing you do best to start over? You know, like, well, what's your strong suit? Hey, I start over real good, you know, like, I'm good for the first 3 or 4 months, and then I go immediately to start over, you know, like, because by that time you catch on to my act, you know, and it's like I'm out of here. But I'm a real great starter. In the first 2 or 3 weeks, I look like I'm going to own the company. And then something happens. I stop off after work, and I miss a couple of months, maybe. And so the reality was I had to start over. So he said, just put it down. Just put down what you can put down. So the first job I went to for an interview, I went in, and they said, fill this out. So I went in the little room, I filled it out, I brought it back. It asked for 3 references, 3 people who they could call who knew me. So I wrote down, Packy M, Alan G, Ed V. The guy came in, he said, where do they live? I said, I don't know. I just have their phone numbers. What's their last names? We'll look them up in the phone book. I don't know their last names. These are the 3 people who mean the most to you and you want to use as a reference and you don't know their last name? No, I don't know their last name. Now, you know, you start to get in a little battle fever. Like, you know, like, hey, yo, you know, I don't know their last name. And then, you know, as he's asking the questions, you realize how idiotic you must sound. You know, and I don't know about you, but when I really begin to sound stupid to me, I know how stupid I sound to someone else. I get very aggressive. I'm not a back off saying, hey, wait a second, I can explain this. It's like, you know, I find like it's someone starts beating drums. You know, I get and he said, now, he said, let's just start with their numbers. If we call them, would they give us their last names? I said, I don't know. No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it works. You know, I don't know. You know, so to make a long story real short, I withdrew. I just said, ah, the hell with it. That's exactly what I said. I said, ah, the hell with it. And I started out the door. And I was down almost to the elevator, and this guy came after me. And he said, look, why don't you come back? He said, we'll have a cup of coffee, which didn't sound bad. He said, and I'll call these people and see if they're willing to give us their last name. He said, I'd like to hire you. So I said, okay. So I went back in the room. And we called, and all 3 gave their last name. You know, all 3 of them gave their last name. And they even gave their addresses. And he thought he knew the one guy's brother. It turned out he didn't, but he thought he knew. And it was like, he said, you can go to work Monday. And it was like, I was separated from my wife. I was going back to my little place. I didn't even have to carry the key anymore because I left the door open. You know, like, I just yelled, hello, I'm home, you know. And if nobody answered, I went in. You know, it was like, you know, life was real simple. I mean, when I look back on it now, it seems so uncomplicated. I mean, it was like this was the best part, I think, of my sobriety starting out. Because as I was doing it, I didn't know anything, which is basically what I'm trying to get to now. And I had absolutely nothing to hold on to. There was no focus of anything. And I was just doing the deal. And then at night, at the first few days I was in, prior to this job, I would start getting ready for the 9 o'clock meeting at about 2 p.m. because I had to have something to do. So I would shower, I would shave, I would look at the clock, I would read this book they gave me for 6-7 minutes. And, you know, try to read it, let go, like, oh, yeah, sure, there was a solution, yeah, wonderful, you know. And then I'd be, you know, getting down to the subway, and I'd be standing there on the platform, and the guys next to me would think I saw the train coming, you know, like, and I'd be, like, waiting for the train to come. And then I'd get to the meeting. And then they'd say, you know, in New York, they don't say, do 12-step work. You know, maybe it's the neighborhood we grew up in, but they always say, go put the hit on this guy. You know, that means take him to a meeting. Don't get excited. You know, they say, go put the hit on this guy. So, you know, after a while, I got a car. I mean, it was a Buick Special, and it was great because I could see the road through the floor. And so, like, in wintertime, I didn't have to worry about, in summertime, rather, I didn't have to worry about air conditioning because I got this constant breeze, you know, of the fumes and stuff coming up. And so, but I put brand new covers on this car. You know, I went down to Sears and Roebuck and bought these slip-on covers. You know, I got blue for my car. It was really exciting. And then they said, go put the hit on this guy. Well, this guy got into my car. The covers were 2 days old. It cost me $18. That's what I felt. And this guy says, I think I'm going to puke. And I said, not on these covers. You know, I said, not on these covers, pal. You know, AA will only take you so far. You know, like, and it was funny because that day a lot was going on in my life. And as this guy was talking about puking on my covers, I forgot all that stuff. By having this guy in my car and by taking him to a meeting, I forgot about everything else that was going on. And when we got there, He settled down a little bit, and then after the meeting, I got to take him home. We went by and had coffee and got to take him home. And when we got to the door, he said the most unbelievable thing I had ever heard in a long, long time. He said, Ken, thank you for taking me to that meeting. I really appreciate it. And he went upstairs. And I stood out there on the street corner, and I thought, wow. That guy just thanked me for doing something. When was the last time anyone thanked me for doing something? And then it occurred to me, when was the last time I did anything for anyone? You know, which was me all more overpowering. And I went home that night and I called up my sponsor and I said, you know what that slob job said? He said he probably thanked you for taking him to the meeting. I hung up. I thought, I don't mind if he hangs up when I tell him what I said, but when he knows in advance what I'm going to tell him, they get it, you know? And so the next day, he didn't call back either. Next day, when I saw him at a meeting, he said, what upset you last night? I said, you knew what that guy had said before I told you. He said, Ken, I know what you're going to say before you tell me. He said, I just have to look at your face. He says, your face is like a map. It tells me exactly where you're at. He said, when you come in and you have that squinty look, I know you're upset. He said, when you come in and your eyes are bulging out, I know you're frustrated. He said, when you come in and you just look the way you look now, stupid, I know there's something going on between us. You know? and you know, it was all of that that got me here. Everything that happened, how insignificant it looked at the time, got me here. And I'm sure as I'm standing here, that on any given day, any guy in this room could go back and put together a scenario of events that got him into this room tonight. And if you looked at it at the time, you would say, where is this taking me? And when you look back on it from the perspective of being here, you say, it's obvious what was intended. I was meant to be here. Everything I did in my life was directed towards getting me right here, right now, right in this moment. There wasn't anything that happened by happenstance. There wasn't one mistake made. Everything that happened played a role in getting me here. Everything played a role in me being who I am today. I want to thank you for letting me come here. It's meant an awful lot to me. It's an experience that I'll have for a long, long time. There's no doubt in my mind. And I want to close with a little story that my mom used to tell, because I love my mom. She was this great stand-up Irish gal who raised seven kids. And she used to tell this story. And this story, to me, is the whole essence of my spiritual growth. And she used to talk about this boy, Johnny. And Johnny went to a parochial school. And if you know anything about parochial schools, they're always next to a church. It's called a captive audience. You know, we got these people here, now we brainwash them. And Johnny used to go into this church every day in the morning, at lunchtime, and after school. And he would kneel down, and he would say, "Hello, God, this is Johnny. I just want to tell you I'm here." And then he'd get up, and he'd leave. And he would do this on Saturday and Sunday. He would do it during the summer. He would do it on holidays, over the Christmas vacation, all the time. "Hello, God, this is Johnny. I just want to tell you I'm here." And then my mom says that when he was about 12, he developed polio. And at that time, there was no cure for polio. And my mom said he was in a room, laying in a bed, and he was dying. And he was surrounded by his parents, his mom and his dad, his school chums, his friends, and his neighbors. And my mom said, a voice was heard to say, "Hello, Johnny, this is God. I just want to tell you I'm here." And the essence of my sobriety is just showing up, just being here. And whenever, it was the theme of the International Convention, whenever anyone anywhere reaches out, one of us goes. We're just there. It's not about what we say. It's not even about so much as what we do. It's about the fact that we're there. When you stand with people who don't have anyone else to stand with, you're standing very tall. And that's what these retreats to me tend to do. It helps you to take home with you that special feeling that, hey, I'm not much, but I'm all I got. And I can be of service in ways that no one else can be in service. And all I have to do that is to be sober and to be there when anyone anywhere reaches out. And so hopefully the flavor of this thing going home in our own directions today is God could and would if he was sought. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And that's the essence of the deal. There is a solution. And this is the solution if you be alcoholic. And you don't have to fragment yourself going in 10 different directions. And as my friend Harish used to say, namaste. Because if you can look for the God in every person you meet, you'll find God in every person you meet. And if you look for the God in yourself, you'll find a comfort that you never knew existed. I have the feeling at this moment that everything is okay. And I have that feeling because you're sitting there looking back at me, telling me that you're here. And I'm telling you, as I stand here, I'm here. And so there's a lot of things that alcoholics have to go through. Just as human beings, we have to go through them. Life gets messy. But the one thing about being an alcoholic that makes it so very damn special is you never have to go through it alone. God bless you. Have a good trip.